This is the beginning of the French part of the course, because today I'm going to talk about the Enlightenment and the sort of the cultural concomitants of the French Revolution, and sort of how people began to imagine an alternate sense of sovereignty in the nation. And then you're in for a treat on Monday, because I have one of the only bootleg copies of the live speech and then the execution of Louis XVI. So I'm going to play that, and also the death of Citizen Marat in the bathtub at the hands of Charlotte Corday. And so that'll be on Monday, and then I'll talk about, inevitably, though I don't particularly like him, Napoleon on Wednesday. So the next three times are about La Belle France, but because the revolution is terribly important, and indeed, in lots of ways, in many places, it's well worth doing. So what I'm going to start, I'm going to do three things today. I'm going to first talk about four things. First, just your basic outline of what difference the Enlightenment made, followed by, with reference to my good friend Bob Darnton's work, the social history of ideas, and look at sort of surprising ways that Enlightenment influence was felt, and not talking about the big-time people like Rousseau and Voltaire, but the Grub Street hacks. And then I'm going to talk a little bit about the public sphere, taking two examples, one from the work of David Bell and one from the work of Sarah Mazza, in which you can see the sort of emergence of this possibly different way of viewing sovereignty, residing in the nation and not in a king. And then look again at what difference, in a very strange way, the Enlightenment made in all of this. So first, the kind of classic stuff, just to review for you. If you had to summarize six ways that the Enlightenment mattered, you might indeed list them like this. First of all, without question, Enlightenment thought, although the Enlightenment thinkers disagreed on many things, and a few were atheists, but not many, but most were deists and believed that God was sort of everywhere, the Enlightenment did weaken the hold of traditional religion, particularly the role of the Catholic Church as a public institution in France. Of course, if you read in high school French or whatever, wherever, Candide, which is blatantly anti-religious of Voltaire, you'll see the most extreme example of that. Secondly, and related to this, the Enlightenment thinkers taught a secular code of ethics, one that was divorced from a religious beliefs, that they were engaged with humanity. They loved humanity. They thought people were basically good, and that this shouldn't be just a valley of tears awaiting eternal life, and went out to make such claims. Third is that they developed a critical spirit of analysis, not to accept routine tradition, sort of passed down, truths that were passed down from generation to generation, particularly those passed down by religious establishment, and not to accept routine a tradition, such, for example, routine hierarchies, and this was part of their spirit of analysis. Fourth, they were curious about history and believed in progress. And they were convinced that France had a special role to play in this. And to be sure, the Enlightenment was to be found in many places in Europe and in the United States, and what became the United States. But nonetheless, Paris particularly played a central role in that. Fifth, that they differentiated absolutism from despotism. And in order to understand, you know, what happens in this remarkable series of events in 1789 and in subsequent years, as I said before, there weren't 10 people in France who considered themselves Republicans, that is, who wanted a republic in 1789, and how it was that two or three years later, well, in 1793, it became easy for the majority of the population to imagine a life without any king at all. And sixth, that, and here's the role of the kind of the Grub Street hacks of the kind of third division of Enlightenment thinkers that I'll talk about in just a few minutes. They heaped abuse against what they considered to be unearned, unjustified privilege, and how can one put this, disrespected the monarchy and indeed the nobles who hung around the king. So one can say in hindsight, because we know what happened next, that the Enlightenment helped prepare the way for the French Revolution, and that the French Revolution transferred power, transferred authority to people who were very influenced by the Enlightenment. The classic example, which I will give because I enjoy talking about him so much, and he is important, is Maximilien Robespierre, who in many ways was a child of the philosophe. As you know, the philosophe, which is such an important word in French, it became a word in English. The philosophe were the thinkers of the Enlightenment. And Robespierre, born in Arras in the northern part of France, and now what is the Pas-de-Calais, was very much influenced by Enlightenment thought. As the 12 of the Committee of Public Safety sat around that big green table making decisions that affected the lives of lots of people in France, Enlightenment influence was certainly there. Now, the Enlightenment stretched across frontiers. And if you do, I think there's a map in the second edition of the book that you're kindly reading that shows the how many where you could find copies of Diderot's famous encyclopedia. And you could find it in South Africa, you could find it in Moscow, you could find it in Philadelphia, you could find it in New York, you could find it in Papal Rome, you could find it all over the place. But one thing that's interesting is that 20 or 30 years ago, so when I was sort of starting out, when people did what they used to call intellectual history was sort of the big ideas, when you could call it the kind of via regia of history, where you've got one idea sort of moving along and it sort of hooks up with another idea, and then a third idea comes as a result of that idea. And it's rather like traditional art history, where you try to decide or discover where it is that Pizarro got his red ochre as a color, or where such and such a Baroque painter got the idea of painting cherubs in a certain way. Now, in the very early 70s, my colleague, retired a long time, a great historian, Peter Gay, coined the phrase the social history of ideas, that ideas too have a history. I mean, who understood Rousseau? Who read Voltaire? Who read the Encyclopedia of Diderot? How do we know how these ideas were used? And so he called for the social history of ideas. And a number of people, including Bob Darton, who's now at Harvard but taught at Princeton for decades and who turned out really the finest historians of old regime France, took this very seriously. So did another friend of mine, Daniel Roche, who did work on the Academy, which I'll discuss in a while. So they began to look at, how did Enlightenment ideas get around? I mean, how did copies of Candide, which was illegal in France, censored, how did these things turn up in France? So let me just say a couple things about this. Enlightenment ideas really came into elite popular opinion in what we call the public sphere. That is, people who were interested in ideas and people who became interested in politics in really three major ways in France. There are equivalents of these in other places. The Scottish example, because the Scottish Enlightenment is very important, I mean, you can read about it in the book, one of these will be quite clear there. First, through academies, academie. But an academy is not a university. It has nothing to do with a university. Academy, and they still exist. I'm a member of one of these academies, an obscure one in the Ardèche. An academy it was a group of sort of erudites, sometimes including clergy, many nobles, many kind of bourgeois people of education who. The population that was literate increases in Western Europe decidedly in the 18th century, and they would get together and they discuss ideas. And they had contests where people who wanted to make a little money would answer a question put out by the Académie, and they would write write responses to questions about, you know, about science and about religion and about ideas, big time ideas. Robespierre wins one of these contests. And these academy meet in smaller rooms than this, but they discuss ideas. And so, I mean, they're with these ideas about, you know, of sort of that are putting in sharp analysis or reevaluation the role of the church as an institution. They have to get around some way. People have to know about them. And the academy is one way this happened. A second one, moving to number three, are Masonic lodges. Masonic lodges still exist. There's one, I don't know if it's still active, but there's a big Masonic building out on Whitney on the right. I think it became an insurance building. And one of the, you know, the horrors of my seventh grade life was having to be dragged off to the dancing school in Portland, Oregon, which met at, you know, in a large building, which was a Masonic lodge. Now, Masonic lodges begin in Scotland, and they are secularizing institutions that the members, mostly all agreed in the 18th century that the church's public role, institution role, is too important. So Masonic lodges talk about these ideas as well. They talk about Rousseau, Diderot, Montesquieu, and all of these people. And so this is a second way in which these ideas get out. And the third is the salon. There's another French word that's so important it became an English word. A salon was, you know, a gathering of pretty elite people, but interested in the life of the mind. They were hosted by hostesses. Again, the role of women in the Enlightenment. I give you in the book the example of Madame Geoffrin, which was the classic one, but people would come together to eat, to drink, and discuss ideas. When British guests came to Paris, the Salon, they said, well, all they do is eat and drink. They spend all their time eating and drinking, and they don't discuss ideas that much. But in fact, they did. And there's still a wonderful place in Paris called the Palais Royal, where you can go, and on very hot days in the 18th century, in the 1770s, you can imagine people meeting there, talking about the ideas of young Enlightenment hotshots, those people who have become part of the canon, you know, of Western civilization. And so this is another way where these ideas get along. And so young would-be philosophes on the make, coming up from the provinces, what they want to do is be introduced to one of these hostesses so that they will be invited to trot out their intellectual wares at one of these gatherings. So these are concrete examples of the way that these ideas got around. And people didn't pay any attention to this before about 30, 35 years ago. Daniel Roche's book on the Academy, two huge volumes, not translated, are really marvelous in all of that. So that's something to keep in mind. Now the High Enlightenment really ends in 1778 traditionally. That's a textbook kind of, but it does matter because that's when Voltaire and his great enemy Rousseau both die. Now, after that, there are no more Montesquieu's or Voltaire's or the big time, the all-stars of the philosophe. There aren't anymore. But there is this next generation of would-be philosophe, people who could think and who could write and who want to hit the big time. And they see that Voltaire made big bucks, big franc, big franc, big livre writing. And they want to be like him. They want to be like Voltaire. Or they want to be like Rousseau, his arch enemy, who paced around his little farm called Les Charmettes in Savoie outside of Chambéry, and who hated Rousseau. I mean, he hated Voltaire. They really couldn't stand each other. But he also hit the big time. And so what the Grub Street hacks, Grub Street refers to, I don't know if it's a real street or imaginary street in London where lots of would-be writers and writers sort of peddling their wares hung around. These Grub Street hacks, the third division of people who want to have the kind of entry into the salon life to put forth their ideas. They live on the top floor of where the poorest people live. They're dodging their landlords all the time. They don't have enough money to pay. A lot of them live in Paris right around now near Odeon. Doesn't matter if you know Odeon at all, but they live right around that part in the Latin Quarter, but more in what now is the 6th arrondissement. And they write. But what do they write about? They need to make money. So the big news here, as Darton discovered, is that they write pornography. They write, you know, scatological pornography. They write what they call in French libelle. They write broadsides, really, denouncing. Denouncing the royal family, denouncing the queen above all, indelicately called the Austrian whore by her many detractors who are omnipresent. They write against what they think is unearned privilege, the kind of censorship that they see is keeping them from hitting the big time. And so with the point of Darton's many wonderful books is that in the long run, these people were the Grub Street hacks. Voltaire denigrated them as the canaille, the rabble, the scribblers, jealous, eager, anxious, hungry, is that their attacks on the regime and against the unearned privilege as they saw it helps erode belief in the monarchy and helps suggest that the monarchy itself and the people hanging around the monarchy at Versailles is lapsing into despotism. So they do make a difference. Now let me give you an example. This is sort of a classic one. Imagine you're a bookseller in Poitiers. Poitiers is a very nice town full of lovely old Romanesque churches in sort of this central western France. And you are writing to Switzerland to order books that you want to sell to people who have ordered books, for example, and he writes the following letter. Here is a short list of philosophical books, you know, books written by the philosophe that I want to order. Please send the invoice in advance. They include Venus in the Cloister, or The Nun in the Nightgown, Christianity Unveiled, that could be the subtitle too, Memories, the Memories of Madame la Marquise de Pompadour, Inquiry on the Origins of Oriental Despotism, The System of Nature, Teresa the Philosopher, Margot the Camp Follower. Now this is not exactly the stuff of Diderot, Voltaire, Rousseau, and these other people. But yet, those who penned such things imagined that they were philosophes and wanted to have the same kind of impact that that Voltaire and the others had. These were the la canaille, the kind of rabble of Grub Street. Now, why was he writing Switzerland to begin with? And again, this is the question of how do these ideas get around? Now, one of the things that the Grub Street hacks didn't like is that you've got censors. You've got paid censors who work for the government who says this can't be published or you shouldn't have published that baby. That wasn't a good idea. And so the result is, because in a system in which privilege, of which monopolies, of which guilds controlled the production and distribution of almost everything, that book selling and book printing are monopolies controlled by the state. So you can't just, if you're a Parisian printer, you know, unless you're risking being thrown in the slammer, in the slammer, that's not a real word in French, obviously. You can't print this stuff out in Paris. So much of the Enlightenment literature is published in, you'll not be shocked to know, you already know this, in Amsterdam, or in Bruxelles, in Brussels, in the southern Netherlands, or in Switzerland. And Bob Darton, when he was a young professor, before that a young graduate student, he hit the jackpot because a lot of the stuff was printed in Switzerland, in Neuchâtel, and he got a hold of the archives of this printing company. So he was able to do the social history of ideas. Who bought what? Oh, by the way, how do you get, before there was Ryanair or any of these places, how do you get all of this stuff from Switzerland, where there are big mountains, into France? How do you get it to Poitiers? How do you get it there? So, again, you have to look at the way that this stuff was distributed. The ideas, we've already seen how they were distributed, but how literally do you get these books, these bouquins, these pamphlets, these brochures from Switzerland, or the equivalent from Amsterdam or Bruxelles, that's easier, a flat country is a little different than mountains, into France? Well, in France, as in the German states, as in Italy, they were peddlers. They would go on the road, and they had, you know, like a medicine ball in a gym, they would have these huge leather bags, and they'd be stuffed with all sorts of things, pens and pins, and I think I mentioned this in another context, and religious literature, but also hidden at the bottom beneath the religious literature, they are smuggling into France Enlightenment literature. And they have drop-off points. They go over the Jura Mountains, that's not so easy to do, and they take them to a city like Chaumont in the east, or Metz, or Nancy, and then somebody else carries the stuff all the way. So avoiding the police around Paris, the gendarmerie, the marechaussee, as they were called then, it doesn't matter, this stuff, Venus, the camp follower, Margot the camp follower, ends up pleasing this drooling guy in Poitiers who can buy it from his bookstore. You can really follow not only Diderot's encyclopedia, and how do we know where Diderot's encyclopedia ended up, by the way? Well, for example, people who leave wills, that's how we know about literature in the 19th century, because people with the libraries in estates would be detailed, so we know what books people had. Now, in the 18th century, we have a tremendous proliferation of ideas, of reading, of literacy, and of ways of discussing these ideas. I've already mentioned three of them there, but if you look at the case of Britain, you've got the coffee house. Coffee houses follow the mania of coffee, and coffee comes from where? The colonies. So coffee houses, are part of this sort of globalization of the economy, but also the globalization of ideas. So this stuff all kind of fits together. These Voltaire and Rousseau and Montesquieu and Diderot and the others would be just horrified to think that anybody in a lecture would be mentioning some of these Grub Street hacks along with them. Because they didn't accept them, and nor were they of the same quality at all. Some of these guys, by the way, there's one who I mentioned in the book, a guy called Brissot, B-R-I-S-S-O-T, who becomes an important leader of a faction in the revolution called the Girondins from around Bordeaux, who are against the Jacobins. More about that later. Brissot is broke. How is he going to pay the landlord? He has no idea. Where is he going to get his next drink? So what's he do? He works for the police. He works as a police informer on the other would-be philosopher on the Grub Street hacks. How do we know this? Darton found the dossier in which Brissot is being paid off by these people. What are another ways that we know how many of these characters there were? There are about 200 or 300. I don't remember exactly. Why? Because they want money. So on one hand, they say, I don't like this censorship. It's keeping people from recognizing my true genius. On the other hand, they write little sniveling letters saying, I am a writer and a very good one indeed, and therefore I merit a state pension. So they write these letters to various equivalent of ministries saying, please give me some money because I am a really wonderful writer, and instead of repressing my work, you should be saluting my genius. And so they write clammy letters like that you find in the archives. So we piece this stuff together gradually. So let me just race over here and just give you just an example of where is this stuff. All right, here we go. What would Voltaire think of this? Here is one of these pamphlets that's denouncing the high livers out at Versailles. The public is warned that an epidemic disease is raging among the girls of the opera, that has begun to reach the ladies of the court, and that it has been communicated to their lackeys. This disease elongates the face, destroys the complexion, reduces the weight, and causes horrible ravages where it becomes situated. There are ladies without teeth, others without eyebrows, and some are now completely paralyzed. So people want to know what is it? What's obviously a venereal disease, and he's obviously exaggerating. Who knows? I mean, I don't know, but the results of such a malady. But what he's doing is he's suggesting that what's really going on at Versailles is lots of people, how to put this politely, hooking up all over the places at the Petit Trianon, whether dressing up as peasants or whatever, and that the result is very demeaning for the French state and for the French monarchy. So does this have an effect? It does. It really does. It contributes to what has been called the desacralization of the French monarchy. That it's very hard to argue that God has put absolute monarchs on earth to bring people better lives if you've got these people, and no one had ever really the ordinary people did not get into Versailles unless they were among the 15,000 lackeys working there. Lackeys would be the term given by the people who employed them. You didn't know, so you had to surmise, you had to guess what was going on. And I'll give you a couple examples in a while, and I better hurry up and do this, in which you can kind of see how this works. I'll give you kind of a spectacularly interesting example, at least I think so, at the end. Now, by the way, just as an aside, and during the French Revolution, you know, Louis XVI decides to get the hell out. And so he and Marie Antoinette improbably dress themselves up as sort of ordinary people. And you know, they're not people who have to set the alarm clock usually. They get up at 3 a.m. and they get in this large carriage that's been stuffed with silver and foie gras and all sorts of other things, and they hightail it toward what is now the Belgian frontier. But they get further and further behind. You can read about this when you get to that chapter. It's an interesting story. And finally, they get recognized. She is not a governess, she is the queen. And one of the people that first realizes this, the king, has actually caught a glimpse of the king himself by looking through the fence at Versailles at the time of a wedding. And he sees the king. There aren't photographs, but he recognizes the king's nose. And he gets down on his knees and says, "Sire, you are the king." And this guy can no longer pretend that he's a mere hanger-on with, assisting a Russian baroness. And it's all over but the shouting at that point. What these people do is they helped break down this sense of automatic respect for the monarchy as an institution. And of course, the fact that they can't stand Marie Antoinette, who rightly or wrongly is accused of all sorts of things. Now, this is a racing head of the story, but Louis XVI was a big-time cuckolded guy because his wife was seriously sleeping around while he was taking apart and putting back together clocks, which he liked to do, in the big house when his wife is out in the bushes. And to put it, crudely, I forgot this is being televised, but anyway, take that back. Can you erase that, please? But what these people do is, over the long run, this helps erode respect for the monarchy and helps us explain why it was in 1789, you can imagine a world without a king and a world without a queen. And when they bring him back, they bring the old boy and his wife back from Varennes, which is in the northeast of France. The National Guard turns their backs in serious disrespect to the carriage, and they hold their guns upside down. And at that point, that's the la fin des haricots, that's the end of the green beans, as the French say, for the king. But this process started earlier, and the third string hacks of the Enlightenment had something to do with it. Now let me give you a couple of examples also from other friends, but really good serious work been done in the last 20 or 25 years. Now let me, rocketing right along here, give you another example of this, the relationship of the public sphere to imagining a new source of sovereignty, that is the nation, and to give you an example of how that works. And this comes from the work of David Bell, who is my colleague and still a very dear friend who teaches at Johns Hopkins, and from his work on lawyers in the 18th century. So we'll see, give an example of how this fits together. Now, it fits in the Enlightenment stuff because if the Enlightenment literature was censored and sometimes hard to get a hold of, though the encyclopedia was tolerated, then not tolerated, and then tolerated again, what Abel's work on lawyers demonstrates is the way in which lawyers and legal briefs help get these ideas around as well, because you could not censor legal briefs. To give you just an aside, that don't worry about this now, in the case of Imperial Russia in the late 19th century, where you had big time censorship by the police, In fact, when there were these trials, political trials, lots of what was said in the courtroom got around as well and couldn't really be censored in the way that ordinary publications could. And so you had the same sort of effect there. So let me give you a couple examples. So they're complicated examples, but just don't worry about them. The first would be from this very strange, not really heresy, called I guess the Catholic Church considered a heresy called Jansenism. I remember once coming in to do the equivalent of this lecture and having to look at my own book for a good definition of Jansenism that I must have found once because it's so obscure. There was a bishop who didn't think he was obscure, but a Belgian bishop who got called Jansen, called Janson, who thought that the Catholic Church was becoming too overmighty and full of big-time broke masses and huge expenses for archbishops who weren't doing a damn thing. And so he imagined another kind of religion that became very ascetic, where it became sort of like they were called, somebody once called them Calvinists who went to Mass. Where they were still Catholic, but they didn't believe in this sort of high broke church. And Jansenism, you know, it's about in 1715 or so, and then it comes back in the 1760s or 1770s. And it's extremely boring stuff. Now, Louis XIV didn't think it was boring. He sent out the troops to burn down Jansenist abbeys, the big ones called Port-Royal outside of Paris, because he thought that this was a threat to the Gallican Church, which is sort of the alliance of the Catholic Church with the monarchy in France. And so rather like Carthage, they were supposed to plow salt into the land and all this business. So they wage war on these Jansenist people, who were rather like Calvinists in many ways. But the only point of that is that there are lawyers who begin to defend the Jansenists and begin to see the actions of the king vis-a-vis this persecuted religious minority as despotic. And so when lawyers are publishing legal briefs, and there's enough references in the book so you can put this together, but I just want you to see the point. When they begin to publish legal briefs defending the Jansenists against these kinds of attacks, these are published by thousands of them, and they can't be censored. And they begin to suggest at a time in the 18th century, particularly after mid-century, when we can already begin to speak of French nationalism, at least among the elite, at the time of the Seven Years' War, 1756-1763, thus the Seven Years' War, that it begins to suggest two things, that monarchies can behave despotically, going beyond the limits of absolute rule, the accepted limits of absolute rule, and that the nation, this idea of the nation, is being betrayed by bad governance. And if this doesn't sound like the French Revolution, then nothing else will. Because those are very important defining moments. Now, the same thing happens also in the 1760s and 1770s, which various attempts to liberalize the French economy that I describe in the book. The king's attempt to dispense with parliaments, the parlement, which were really noble law courts that were provincial. You can read about this. But the same thing happens, and this is the point, is that these lawyers begin turning out these legal briefs that imply two things, the same two things, that absolute monarchy is risking stepping over the lines of the acceptable, and behaving in a despotic way, and that there is something called the nation, in which nobody ever imagined that classes were all equal. The discourse of liberty, fraternity, equality is a hell of a long way away, but that the rights of the nation, traditional rights of the nation, are being betrayed by the monarchy, and that things ain't so good at Versailles. And so, again, trying to look ahead and see what happens in 1788 and, above all, 1789, which is one, I'm not a big guy on dates in history, you have to remember all these dates, but 1789, like 1914 or like 1917, that's a big one. That's a big one. But in order to also understand the emergence of a radical republic and the execution of the king, one has to see that the nation becomes invested with a sense of moral quality that is that makes it not impossible to imagine a world without kings. And so lawyers, who are called barristers, play a major role in all of this. Now again, this has to be seen in the context of a century in which more and more people can read. Now, the literacy rate in a country like France is still well below 50%, maybe say 40, 45%, something like that. More men could read than women. But literacy, not only literacy increases among the elite, but the amount of things that are published and the amount of newspapers that are published, that this expands dramatically. A point of reference would be in England, and you can in Britain you can read about this, but the campaign of John Wilkes, who was sort of a, you know, kind of a rascally character. But Wilkes and the number 45 becomes virtually illegal because 45 was the number of a newspaper in which Wilkes essentially and his supporters call out the British political system. And so, again, we're talking mostly about Western Europe, and literacy is much higher in the Netherlands and in northern France and in northern Italy and in England than in other places. But this is part of this cultural revolution that it's important to see the role of this. Because, you know, Orthodox Marxist interpretation, you had to have the ever-rising bourgeoisie. They're rising in the 14th century. There they are again in the 16th century. They're like some sort of runaway bread or something like that. In the 19th century, there they are, the bourgeois century. I'll give a lecture on the bourgeoisie because they do indeed rise. But nonetheless, you know, kind of class analysis can't be completely thrown out. I mean, classes did exist, and people had a sense of themselves as being members of a social class. I mean, that's the way it was not immutable. But these boundaries were more fluid in Britain than in other places, but still it's important. But now, for the last 30 years, people have paid more attention to kind of the cultural concomitants of revolution, and what difference Enlightenment ideas made, and what difference the emergence of a sense of the nation. And the infusion of politics with a sense of right and wrong and morality is an important part of all this. So let me, in the last 12 minutes and 30 seconds that I have today, let me give you another example of this. And this is I think a fascinating. Let me find it. It's so fascinating I can't find it. But let me. Give you an example, and this drawing upon an excellent book by Sarah Maas. It's a very well-known episode, but it shows you, kind of ties together the sense of the nation along with the impact of this sort of third string of Enlightenment, or third generation of Enlightenment hacks after 1778, to understand their role in the erosion of a sense that the monarchy was immutable in representing the rights of a nation, even as that construct was just coming into being, and that in this book called what's it called, Public Life, Private Affairs, I'm bad on titles, Maza takes a couple of cause célèbre. A cause célèbre would be like one of the things that you find in the tabloids in Britain or the U.S. One of these sort of, I don't read that stuff, so I really can't give it a good example. But you know, one of these actors and actresses you always see running around, or whatever this person is, Britney Spears or something like that, singer, actress, I don't know what she does, but anyway, but you know, something like that people focus their attention on these people, and they sort of dominate, if you will, this sort of almost an insane comparison, but the public sphere, in that they're in the news all the time. And so what Maza did about the same time that David Bell was working on the role of lawyers in the 18th century is that she took a couple of these examples and shows the way in which private affairs that were, you know, kind of sleazy and not too cool, but were sensational, helped bring these threads together and contribute to kind of erode the prestige of the monarchy. Now, and this fits into the sense that I've already given you that was extremely pervasive, particularly around Paris, is that a lot of things that went on at Versailles weren't so good. And that, you know, that the 10,000 nobles who were clustered around Louis XVI, and particularly his wife, were undermining the authority and the prestige of the monarchy, and that wasn't a good thing. So an incident called the Diamond Necklace Affair is illustrative and mildly amusing, not more than that. It also involves this Palais Royal in Paris before. A woman called Jeanne de Saint-Rémy, the name doesn't matter at all, was a poor noble. She'd claimed descent from the royal family. She had a pretty good education. She had important protectors. And so she married an officer of rather dubious noble title, who was called, quite forgettably, the Marquis de la Motte. He met the 50-year-old cardinal called Louis de Rohan, whose name I should have put on there, R-O-H-A-N, who was from a very famous old family called Rohan-Soubise. The National Archives used to be, now they're adjacent to it, in this fabulous old, God, why don't they ever have things that work in here? It's just it's unbelievable. Anyway, I can't find anything to write with. The family called the Rohan-Soubise, S-O-U-B-I-S-E. There's this wonderful, wonderful palace, really chateau in the Marais, which is still there. And this cardinal is on the make. He's very, very wealthy. He's a cardinal. That's why he's wealthy, or he's wealthy because he's a cardinal. He's also he thinks he snubbed the queen. He wants to be one of the people who help make important decisions, but he thinks he's alienated the queen. That this is standing between him and the power that he thinks he should have. He writes missives to the queen, begging her to forgive him. He's met this guy, de la Motte, and they begin sending forged replies from the queen that suggest that, the queen now is listening, and maybe, you know, all is forgiven and it's going to be okay. So they have this idea. There's a famous jewel that had 647 flawless gems worth £1.5 million, which is a whole lot of money in those days and still now. Louis XV had commissioned it for one of his mistresses and then backed down because it was too expensive. In 1788, the necklace was offered to Louis XVI for Marie Antoinette, but he turned it down, saying the realm needs more ships than it does more jewels, which was reasonable enough. Now they con this old, fairly horny cardinal too, into showing up at dusk at the Palais Royal and introducing him to the queen herself, whom I guess he'd met once. But it's dusk and his eyesight isn't that good. And so what they do is they find this prostitute, of which there are about 25,000 in Paris at any one time, who looks vaguely like Marie Antoinette. And so this cardinal, de Rohan, thinks that his ship has come in, that everything is going to be okay. And this purchase order has been forged, supposedly signed by the queen, and the real jewels are delivered. And then, of course, it's broken up into pieces and sold on the street for zillions of francs, sold on the black market in London and in Paris. But there's a problem here, because the word gets out what has happened. And de Rohan, who has really been made a fool, there's just no doubt about it. But it's more serious than that, because what he has done is he has taken, he could be accused of lèse majesté, which is just the ultimate kind of insult, plotting against the queen by identifying her, a prostitute, as the queen herself. And so the monarchy, to make a very long story short, the monarchy, humiliated by all of this, the cardinal is saying mass in his fancy robes in some cathedral, probably Saint-Eustache, but I'm not sure. It might have been Notre Dame. I don't know. Well, Saint-Eustache isn't a cathedral, but anyway. He's in his robes, and so the police come in and they arrest him. And so what happens then is they put him on trial. Now, he is not a terribly lovable guy, or not someone to be very much admired. But by an incredible series by almost logical playing out of what I've been saying, the lawyers who defend him and the crowds who salute him portray him as a victim of a regime that is crossing the line between absolutism and despotism. That he is a cardinal and he becomes the darling of the people. And of course, poor old Jean, this noble, I mean, she and her boyfriend get branded and they're sent off to the galleys, et cetera, et cetera, predictably enough. But the Parlement of Paris acquits the good cardinal, and he emerges from the Palace of Justice, or from the Parlement, still now on the Ile de la Cité, the largest of the then three, but now two islands, in the Seine, to a popular acclaim, saying that that justice and the interests of the nation have been served by his acquittal. So what this sleazy unsavory incident does is it helps continue the desacralization of the French monarchy. And again, lawyers and the people who see themselves as representing the interests of the French nation are in their own imaginary and in their own mental construction and in the eyes of people who follow these events in legal briefs and in newspapers, the guy is acquitted, he's seen as somebody who had been done wrong to by a monarchy that has gone too far. And that exactly, not much more than a year later, is what it's going to play out in the French Revolution itself. So, to conclude, Voltaire, Diderot, Montesquieu, who you've been reading, and these folks have big time impact on the way we look at the world around us. And they had an impact on those people who would become the organizers of the revolution and indeed the leaders of France and their children, their successors in the 19th century. But lawyers, part of this sort of culture of increased public sphere that was Western Europe in particular, but also parts of the rest of Europe too, in the 18th century, had a role in all of this. And that by 1789, not in any kind of inevitable process, a revolution was not inevitable, but the sense that the monarchy had gone too far and that there was something called the nation out there was in the public sphere, and the results of all of this would be there to see in 1789. Now, have a good weekend, and on Monday you're going to hear the execution of the king, the death of Citizen Marat in his bathtub, and then I hope to make clear why some people supported the revolution and others didn't, and what difference it all made. So have a great weekend. See you.